dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the War of Ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. A man who I consider to be hugely gifted when it comes to intelligence, particularly in the national security space, is the national security reporter for the Washington Times. He's also the author of the bestseller Rumsfeld's War, the untold story of America's anti-terrorist commander. He is, of course, Rowan Scarborough, good friend of this program and of me personally, and I'm very grateful for his participation with us from time to time. Rowan, good to have you. Welcome back. Rowan, you did a terrific piece in the Times on the 6th under the headline Impeachment 2.0. Democrats line up possible new charges against Trump. I'm not sure whether it's 2.0 or 4.0 or 5. I've lost track, frankly, but certainly they've been at this for a long time. Give us a flavor, if you would, of what the Democrats now seem to be trying to undertake in the wake of what I would consider to be a pretty humiliating repudiation in the hands of the Senate last week.
So Adam Schiff, when he took control of the Intelligence Committee after the 2018 election, he opened this broad probe into Trump, in his family, in his businesses, any aspect of his life. And then the whistleblower came along with the complaint about the Ukraine, and that's paused that investigation, and Schiff took his staff, which includes some people who came from the Trump NSC, from the Obama NSC, and sicked them on 100% of the time the Ukraine investigation. So that's over now. They voted to acquit, and what Schiff has done is he's gone back to the Trump Organization investigation, which he lists as money laundering, tax evasion, undue influence from the Russians, a whole list of things that remain totally unproven. There is no evidence I know of in the public domain to prove any of them. But that's what he has now gone back to. And I assume his objective is still to try to impeach Trump again. He's just going to rummage around, maybe sign some warrants for bank records, things like that, to see what he can find. And then Nadler, meanwhile, has never dropped his obstruction of justice probe on the House Judiciary Committee. So he's picking that back up. So when you say impeachment 4.0, that's probably a pretty accurate description of what they're after.
Yeah. And Nancy Pelosi, of course, the House Speaker, is fully on board with this ongoing effort to find some basis upon which, at the very least, to sully Donald Trump further, if not to actually have him removed from office. Rowan, again, you're a serious student of these matters and have been reporting on the activities, among others, of the House Intelligence Committee for a long time. This does seem to me to be largely, if not entirely, sort of out of the portfolio, the responsibilities, the jurisdiction of the House Intelligence Committee to be, well, as you say, rummaging around in Trump's business dealings and personal affairs. Am I missing something?
No, it's not. This is not typical intel operations at all. You're right, Frank. They're supposed to be an oversight committee to investigate our intelligence agencies and issues that arise. They are not supposed to decide we're going to investigate the president's private life in his business life. That should be, if that needs to be done, you know, that should be done by the Judiciary Committee or perhaps some special committee. But, you know, from the day Adam Schiff read that dossier in January 2017, he is convinced that Trump is totally corrupt. And it doesn't matter that none of the charges in the dossier against Trump prove true, even though Adam Schiff read them at hearings. He talked about them at all sorts of TV appearances. He defended Christopher Steele repeatedly. And all of that fell through as one of the biggest hoaxes ever played on the American public. That doesn't bother Adam Schiff. He's just moving on to 2.0 now. And as some Republican staffer told me, he is just convinced that if he looks long enough, he will find some trail of some money going someplace that is not proper, and then he will try impeachment again. So that's where we lay today.
I don't know if this is something that you would care to speculate about, but I would be interested, Rowan, in your personal judgment as much as your professional evaluation. It seems to me hard to believe that Democrats in the House of Representatives, as much as they obviously are determined to try to depose Donald Trump, as much as they hate him, though I think honestly this has much more to do with his presidency, his agenda, his, you know, actual accomplishments at the expense of their ideological agenda than it does a personal enmity towards him, though that's obviously there too. But I just wonder, does anybody still want to follow Adam Schiff, given the extraordinary record of, at best, incompetence, and at worst, just outright malfeasance? I mean, failure to tell the truth, among other things, serially about these charges, about, well, his assessment of, you know, the facts, for that matter. What do you make of his standing in the House of Representatives at the moment and the likelihood that they might once again, if he managed to come up with something, conjure it up out of whole cloth again, that he would actually succeed in prevailing upon the House to follow him forward on another impeachment gambit?
I do not detect, Frank, any dent in Schiff's support among the Democratic delegation in the House. I don't. They see him as their path to bring down Trump, or, as you alluded to earlier, at least to bloody him up. Democrats are so wedded to Adam Schiff as the person who can bring down Trump that when he made up quotes from the Zelensky-Trump phone call and Republicans challenged him on the Hill in a vote on the House floor, he did not lose one vote, Adam Schiff. They all voted on his side. So all of the things that he has twisted, the facts that he has twisted, has not affected them one bit, as long as they see down at the end of the river that the end of Donald Trump is a possibility.
Well, as they say, the ends justify the means for the left, don't they? Rowan Scarborough, fascinating insights. I hope you're wrong, and I think it's certainly fair to say that that was then and this is now, but you probably are right. The party discipline on the left is such that it may well be that even so discredited, so disreputable an individual as Adam Schiff could nonetheless prevail once again in the partisan supercharged Democratic caucus in the House. We will see. You will be reporting on it at the Washington Times. I hope you'll be coming back to us with regularity. Thank you so much, Rowan. Good to talk with you, my friend. Next up, we'll speak with George Raceley. We'll talk a bit more about this campaign against Donald Trump and much more with George right after this.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney. You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
We're back, joined by George Raceley. He is this program's certified genius, a member of the Mensa Society, and a wonderful resource, the editor of Conservative HQ, Richard Viguerie's project, a very important outlet for conservatives, among others, to think seriously about the major public policy challenges of our time, about which George writes brilliantly. He is also a longtime denizen of the swamp, though he has escaped it of late, but he has served our country with distinction in a number of capacities, including, as I recall, with former Vice President Dan Quayle. It's great to have you back, George. Welcome. So, George, there's a development in just the past 24 hours or so that I wanted to get your thoughts on. The president has evidently withdrawn the nomination of Jesse Liu, who had until recently been the U.S. attorney for the District of Columbia. She had been nominated to a senior position in the Treasury Department as the Undersecretary for Terrorism and Financial Crimes. What's all that about?
Well, Jesse Liu was a terrible choice for U.S. attorney for D.C., and she was chosen really as a product of the dysfunctional reign of Johnny DiStefano and Rince Priebus at the beginning of the Trump administration.
That was the personnel director, White House personnel director, and of course the chief of staff at the time, early on in the Trump administration.
Yeah, she was totally unfit for the role of the top prosecutor in the D.C. circuit. And, you know, why Trump wanted to elevate her to one of the top sub-cabinet positions at Treasury was certainly beyond me, but apparently he finally, you know, got the real scoop on her and withdrew the nomination, which is, I consider to be a fabulous development.
Let's talk a little bit about what she did while she was U.S. attorney. Among other things, it's been a great frustration of mine, the failure to prosecute the Awan brothers, this Pakistani expat family who had been running the various IT services for something like 40 different Democratic members of the House of Representatives in what sure looked to me like a foreign intelligence operation emanating from Pakistan. She gave them a complete pass on a whole host of seeming criminal activities, as well as some very problematic intelligence activities, no?
Well, she did, and I refer to that bunch as the Awan spy ring, and I would, you know, be happy if they would sue me for defamation so we could begin to the discovery process. Anyway, not only did she not call them to account for the, you know, untold hundreds, thousands, millions of terabytes of data they stole from the House of Representatives, she let them get away with the money that they stole as well. So, you know, it was a massive cover-up that she engaged with Paul Ryan on, and it's potentially, you know, one of the most serious data breaches that the U.S. government's ever had.
And we really don't know the full extent of it. Luke Rosiak has done some terrific work, both as a reporter and as an author of an important book on the subject. But I think the story is not yet fully out. In addition, she also was involved in the prosecution of several folks who are now kind of household names: Lieutenant General Mike Flynn, Paul Manafort, and Roger Stone, who is much in the news as we speak. Tell us what you make of her role in all of that, Jesse Liu, that is, but also the current thrash that's going on about the sentencing of Roger Stone on several charges that she had prosecuted.
Well, the treatment of General Flynn and Stone were both outrageous. And, you know, she was clearly, use the word conspiring with the anti-Trump forces in those two prosecutions. And the treatment of General Flynn has been an outrage from the very beginning. And, you know, I can't think of words that have more than four letters to describe it. You know, the same with Roger. I mean, Roger actually, many years ago, held my present position, heading up Mr. Vigory's online, at that time it was a print magazine, but we now do it online. And again, you know, what Roger was prosecuted for Comey, Brennan, a long list, Mueller, a long list of high-profile anti-Trump names have done the same or worse and have received, you know, accolades in the establishment media as opposed to, you know, a SWAT team arriving at their house to arrest them.
In the middle of the night. You're speaking here of lying to the FBI specifically?
Lying to the FBI and lying to Congress.
That's Congress, of course, as well. Yeah. So this brings us to the question of, I think it was 7 to 9 years that the prosecutors were demanding be meted out as punishment to Roger Stone for doing these untoward things that, as you say, others have been given a complete pass on. The president says that this was wrong, but we're told he said it after the Justice Department, I guess in the person of the Attorney General, Bill Barr, decided it was wrong, unduly onerous punishment for such crimes as he's been convicted of. What is your take on this, and do you anticipate that this is now going to translate into yet another line of attack against both, of course, Bill Barr, but also Donald Trump by his very determined opponents in the House of Representatives?
Yeah, I mean, the Democrats are, of course, going to try and turn this into some kind of impeachable offense or otherwise keep the fire burning at Trump's feet. And I honestly think, from, you know, my perspective of being involved in politics for 40 years plus, and every presidential campaign from 1976 to 2008, that nobody out in real America outside the Beltway gives a darn whether, you know, Roger Stone gets 6 months or 6 years. But I don't think that Trump did anything wrong in tweeting, or for that matter, if he'd have called up Barr and said, geez, Bill, what's going on here? Neither of those acts would be, you know, contrary to any statute that I can think of.
Well, and it does seem as though in the end we're going to see something closer to justice served and hopefully another cause celeb in the litany of challenges to Trump will pass, as you say, because it's not, frankly, relevant to the lives of most Americans. Let me ask you quickly in closing, George Raceley of Conservative HQ, to sort of set up a conversation I'll be having momentarily with Ken Timmerman about Iran. You have come out fairly forthrightly as saying, I think quite correctly, that Iran has been at war with this country for decades, 40, I think, years, in fact. What is needed now in terms of an effective response to those years of not just bellicose rhetoric, but actual harm to this country and its vital interests and allies?
Yeah, I mean, Iran declared war on the United States in 1979. They've been pursuing an asymmetric campaign against us ever since. They've killed hundreds, if not thousands, of Americans, depending on how you want to, you know, count it. And the only thing that's going to change that is regime change in Iran. I mean, they're, you know, the 12er ideology, if you will, demands that they conduct a war against us. And the problem is that, you know, all the generals and politicians who've been in charge have never had the imagination to say, well, gee, there are more choices than an all-out shooting war or continuing to let us attack them. And we ought to, you know, have an aggressive intelligence operation with the strategic intent of changing the regime there.
Amen. This is a subject that we will get into in more detail with our friend Ken Timmerman. But George Raceley, thank you both for your thoughts on that incredibly important topic, but also more generally, the state of our polity. Thanks for your service to it in various capacities as well, both in government and, as you say, in the political mundo politico, I guess you want to call it. Thank you as well for just being such a good friend and the great work at Conservative HQ. Keep it up. Come back to us again very soon, if you would. Ken Timmerman is up next with more on Iran right after this.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
We're back. We're joined by one of my favorite people. Ken Timmerman is one of the country's preeminent investigative reporters with an enormous number of associations and accomplishments to his credit in the journalistic business, but we also honor and recognize him for his terrific work as the president and CEO of the Foundation for Democracy in Iran, and in the course of which work he was nominated for the Nobel Peace Prize some years ago. He is also a quite accomplished author, both of fiction and nonfiction works. His most recent book is ISIS Begins, a novel about the Iraq War. It's always a delight to have him with us. Ken Timmerman, welcome back. You have indefatigably, in the course of decades of work, Ken Timmerman, championed the cause of the people of Iran, who are brutally repressed by a regime that is horrific to them, but also threatens us, of course. Are you sensing that we may be seeing the end of this regime at hand, at last?
I do see light at the end of this very dark 41-year-long tunnel, Frank. And I see it because there are stories from inside Iran that some of the senior IRGC leadership are seeking to get their families out of the country, seeking to get their fortunes, their pillaged fortunes, out of the country. And you saw these enormous protests recently that were brutally put down. They erupted all across the country, and they were clearly aimed at the regime and personally at the supreme leader. That used to be, only 2 or 3 years ago, a red line that no demonstrator would be allowed to cross. The regime is responding by outlawing half of its own allies from running for the parliament, for the majlis in the upcoming elections this month. Really, that shows me that they feel themselves more on the ropes than they have been before. So yes, I do see some light here.
Rats abandoning the sinking ship is always a promising sign about the future course of that vessel, that's for sure. Ken, you know, I'm often told by people, well, this is impossible, that the power of the regime is so great, and the lack of capabilities on the part of the protesters to do much besides protest is so acute that, you know, this dismal state of affairs is going to continue interminably. And I'm reminded, as I'm sure you are, there are other examples of it, but this one particularly sticks in my mind, of the fate of Nicolas Ceausescu and his even more notorious wife, who went from being the president and first lady of Romania for life to being corpses almost, you know, instantaneously when the security personnel of that country decided that they were going to be better off without this odious pair than under their continued rule, which they were propping up. That sounds to me as though it might be in store for this regime. Both, do you think that's possible, that we could in fact see this kind of reversal of fortunes in short order, despite all of the prognostications? And what should the United States be doing now to try to advance that?
Well, you know, Frank, having lived through the Cold War, as you did, having been in Europe at the time of the fall of the Berlin Wall and of the Ceausescu's demise, I was thinking of Ceausescu as we were talking. Indeed, that is a That definitely comes to mind when you think of Iran, except they would have to get rid of 350 Ceausescus. It's not just Khamenei, the supreme leader. It's the top mullahocracy, these senior mullahs and senior IRGC officials at the head of the regime. But it is not far-fetched. The regime is more powerful internally than it has been before. They have more anti-riot forces. Again, 3, 5, 10 years ago, they could not have put down revolts in more than a couple of cities at the same time. Now they're putting out the fires all across the country, but the fires keep on erupting. What we can do is to continue and intensify what President Trump has been doing. Number one, isolate the regime diplomatically. Incredibly important to the people of Iran to see that we do not legitimize the regime by doing a new Iran deal, for example. Number two, increase the sanctions. People say, well, what's left to sanction? There's a lot left to sanction. One thing that the U.S. has announced, but I haven't seen it happen yet, is to sanction the family members of top regime officials who are here in the United States, either with green cards or, get this, Frank, with U.S. passports. Okay, we have the sons and daughters of just about every single top leader, except for Khamenei himself, and I believe some of his grandchildren are here, but not his direct children, here in the United States. We can kick them out of the country and freeze their assets. Very, very important. And third, you know, I have always been a big advocate of stepping up our broadcasting and helping the Iranian people get on the internet when the regime shuts it down. We haven't done those two yet. So there's more for this administration to do.
Indeed. It's a little tricky to get rid of people who hold U.S. passports, is it not?
It is, but if they acquire those passports by committing fraud, they can be deprived of their citizenship. And I think that's something that we should absolutely be doing.
Ken, let me turn to some of the manifestations of what this regime has been up to that have made it a danger, not just to its own people, and for that matter to us, but to others in the region. Talk us through a little bit about what is the current state of affairs in Lebanon and Iran's continuing efforts to essentially control its future through its proxies in Hezbollah.
Well, Iran has owned Hezbollah from the beginning, from 1982, late 82, early 1983. But in recent years, with, unfortunately, I have to say, Michel Aoun, a Maronite Christian, as president of Lebanon, they own the entire government of Lebanon. Aoun has thrown in his lot with Iran. He has brought Hezbollah in as a partner to his government for some years. As a result, the U.S. has suspended aid, military aid, which we should have done, and we should just cut it off, in my opinion, completely. The Iranians are relying increasingly on Hezbollah in Iraq, of all places, now that Qasem Soleimani is no longer there to forge this or to hold together this anti-American coalition in Iraq. And in the past 2 weeks, we've seen Hezbollah leaders from Lebanon being dispatched by their Iranian masters into Iraq to try to get everyone back on the same page against the United States, especially people like Muqtada Sadr. So Hezbollah is now playing a bigger international role for Iran that Qasem Soleimani is gone.
And as with the ability to crack down on its own population, Ken Timmerman, I assume that part of Hezbollah's continuing ability to perform these kinds of functions, whether it's in Lebanon or whether it's in Iraq or, you know, overseas operations elsewhere, is the continuing sort of legacy of Barack Obama's returning $150 billion to this regime, is it not?
Yeah, it's a bit difficult even for terrorists to run through $150 billion in a couple of years, Frank. That was really a godsend for all of them, for the regime itself, for their foreign bank accounts, and for their foreign proxies. But Hezbollah also has an independent financial income stream, if you wish, through Venezuela and Latin America, the tri-border region with Paraguay and Brazil. They are running cocaine into West Africa and then up into Europe. They essentially have become the top drug runners. And this, according to the DEA, the Drug Enforcement Administration here in the United States. So they've got this additional income stream, and that puts them right on our southern border. We shouldn't forget that.
Ken, let me switch gears quickly. We only have a couple minutes left, but as you are one of our duty experts on matters involving the Middle East, and you've spent a lot of time watching what Recep Tayyip Erdogan is doing in Turkey, and now increasingly elsewhere in the region, notably against the Kurds in Syria, and now with sort of foreign legionnaires in Libya. What is Erdogan up to, and how serious a problem does it pose to American interests in that region, perhaps, and beyond?
Well, wretched Tayyip Erdogan is up to no good at all. And you mentioned this recent move into Libya, astonishing to many people who haven't been tracking his goals, which are to establish an Islamic caliphate across the Middle East. Okay, let's be very clear about that. But watching him move into Libya, trying to separate Israel from a budding relationship with Cyprus and Greece to exploit oil and natural gas in the Mediterranean off the Cyprus coast. That is his goal as well. He has actually declared a sea lane between Turkey and Libya, an exclusion zone that the Israelis can't get into. Erdogan is, he's involved in northern Syria. He's been attacking our friends and allies, the Kurds in northern Syria. He's always been part of the anti-Israel crusade, welcoming Hamas into Turkey and supporting Hamas militarily and politically and even financially. I find the recent U.S. tilt and some of the statements by envoy James Jeffries towards Erdogan absolutely unconscionable. We should not be sucking up to a dictator who despises America. He hates us to the core. He makes no bones about it. And he's sucking up to Russia as well and buying weapons from them. I really think that we should be cutting, and China. I really think we should be pulling out of Incirlik, the air base in Incirlik, and moving it to someplace like Erbil in northern Iraq, where the Kurds would love to have us. I've spoken to Kurdish generals. We said, we would welcome you with open arms. Please come.
And that raises the question about what to do with their membership in NATO as well, Ken, but it would clearly be easier to address that problem if we weren't depending upon them for our base in Incirlik, that's for sure. Ken, we have to leave it at that for the moment. There's so much more to talk with you about. I hope you'll come back to us again soon for a longer visit. I appreciate your expertise as well as your service to our country, notably in the capacity of president of the Foundation for Democracy in Iran. Thank you for your leadership in that area, among so many others. Come back to us again soon. Next up, we'll be speaking with Todd Bensman of the Center for Immigration Studies about border security and its absence, and what that all means for you, right after this.
Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio. Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
We're back, and I'm very pleased to say we're joined by Todd Bensman. He is one of the utility infielders at a terrific organization we feature here as often as we possibly can, the Center for Immigration Studies. He's their senior national security fellow and brings to that position an extraordinary wealth of experience in journalism, in the Texas Department of Public Safety's Intelligence and Counterterrorism Division. He is an extraordinary resource, both for CIS.org, where you can follow him closely, and for us here at Secure Freedom Radio. We're always delighted to feature him. Welcome back, Todd. Thank you so much for taking the time to join us.
Thanks for having me, Frank.
So I wanted, because you follow things closely on both sides of the border from your vantage point in Texas, to get your current sort of status report on border security, insecurity, challenges, and imperatives.
Well, I just came back from the Mexico-Guatemala border, where I spent 10 days traveling up and down the length of it and also into the interior of both countries to get a sense of what's happening in terms of the mass migration crisis and caravans of 2018 and 2019. And what I found was that the Trump administration policies were at a point now where we can declare those pretty successful. We reduced the mass migration from 100,000 a month, 144,000 at its peak, to about 35,000 in January, somewhere between 30 and 40,000 still, which is high, too high still, but it's not at the crisis levels. And the reason for that is because the primary reason for that I found is because of Mexico's policies and practices on its border, on its southern border. They have deployed the National Guard effectively at 53 interior roadblocks, checkpoints, to staunch the tide of buses and commercial buses and trucks that had been ferrying tens of thousands a day toward the U.S. border. That's over. The Mexicans also have implemented a policy where they're requiring anybody that comes into their territory to apply for Mexican asylum, which is a process, that's a bureaucratic process that's pretty unpleasant. And they have to stay in the south of Mexico. They are not allowed to proceed further. That has created a deterrence. Word has spread through the grapevine southward, don't come to Mexico right now. It's a bad thing. I interviewed many migrants who have decided to stay in Mexico. And when I asked, why did you, achieving the Mexican dream, your great objective? And the answer was, no, we're going to stay here because we gamble that the President Trump will lose the 2020 election. Democrats will take over and undo all of this, and we can proceed on in less than a year. So there is a great pressurized expectation throughout Latin America, Central America, and really, frankly, the rest of the world, that President Trump is the only thing holding them back, and that he'll be defeated and everything will turn around and they can come through.
So it's a stay of execution more than the commutation of the sentence that we will be facing with these folks. They're coming in due course. They're just not coming right now, which means that there's, I guess, that much more urgency associated, is there not, Todd Bensman, with sealing that southern border on our part, that is to say, building the wall in the places that it is not yet in place and strengthening such parts of it that need to be upgraded?
Well, there's the physicality part. Barriers certainly help, but along with barriers, you have to have legislative fixes, permanent fixes to the magnetizing policies and loopholes that we have primarily in our asylum system right now, where people have understood that if they can just reach the border and find a uniformed officer, that they can claim asylum and get right in. And
especially if they have kids with them, right?
That's right. And the administration is working on a number of those through executive power only, but that's insufficient. You're going to have congressional legislation. But in the meantime, he's done a pretty good job. The administration's done a pretty good job of cobbling together a number of kinds of diplomatic, bilateral, and trilateral agreements with those countries to our south that have really deterred new immigration.
Yeah. I wanted to ask you about another piece of this, as I understand it, and it's heartening to hear what Mexico's doing along its southern border, but that it has actually been very helpful as well along its northern border with us, our southern border, namely with respect to requiring, you know, those who are seeking to achieve asylum in the United States to be processed in Mexico. Give us a current update on that, if you would.
Well, MPP is probably, that's the Remain in Mexico policy, which is a pushback policy, has been extraordinary in its impact on decision-making in the minds of migrants. I've interviewed many migrants about this, and they tell me anywhere in Mexico that I find them that, you know, this is really a traumatic, unexpected event in their lives. Nobody expected it, that they would have to wait for a long period of time in Mexico to lose their claims. They're all going to lose their claims. They wanted to win. They wanted to lose their claims inside the United States so they could disappear. Now they have to lose their claim in a country where they're going to have to either stay or go home.
Right. And they don't much want to stay there, I take it. Now, this is the unsung story, I guess, really is that the Trump administration pulled off this rather dramatic change with respect to Mexican policy. Todd Bensman, between the corruption and the importance and dominant position of the narco traffickers and a leftist president of Mexico and a lot of hostility to the United States and certain parts of the Mexican body politic, shall we say, this would be an extremely improbable outcome. How has this been achieved?
Well, it's really kind of simple. First of all, the success is extraordinary. You just have to give it to the president. Even his most ardent critics are complaining about his success, which is a backhanded compliment. The linchpin of the whole thing was a threat. Mexico's not doing this out of a friendly alliance. The Mexicans are doing this under duress because this president was willing to use raw American economic power to threaten the country with progressive trade tariffs that would have reached 25% had they not done something measurably actionable. And he had a credible threat.
He has done it to the Chinese, after all. So it's, among others, the Turks at various points.
It's a pretty rare use of that kind of power. I don't think anybody's seen that since the Teddy Roosevelt days.
But it got their attention in Mexico City.
It got their attention, and you have Mexican elites and interests, powerful interests in Mexico that would have pressured Obrador, the AMLO, to, you know, put the National Guard on the border and to implement these policies, which have been incredibly successful for the Mexicans. I'll just give you one quick example. I was there when the last caravan came in. I met them, the lead elements of the caravan in Guatemala. The purpose of that caravan was to push and pressure and test and probe the Mexican defense. And if they could break it down, then it would just reopen the whole migrant crisis again. The Mexicans met them with National Guard and 36 buses and airplanes at the Tapachula Airport and loaded up, captured 2,000 of the caravanners, loaded them up, and drove them back to Honduras and ended that caravan. And then subsequent caravans were forming up. Now we don't hear anything about those subsequent.
At least until after the election, when they think they might have a better shot at it. Todd Bensman, this is an extraordinarily helpful and frankly very encouraging update. I hope you'll come back to us with continuing reports in the course of the year. This couldn't be more important, as you understand better than anybody and really cover better than just about anybody. Thank you for the work you do at the Center for Immigration Studies. Come back to us again in the near future, if you will. I hope the rest of you will come back to us again tomorrow. Same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Affney. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.